This is roll number 6, Westmoreland.
I would like just to mention a couple of things, and then I will turn the microphone over to Dean Samuel Williamson, the College of Arts and Sciences, who will be moderating tonight's session. As you may be aware, and I mean to make more of you aware of it,
on behalf of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, I'd like to welcome all of you to this second evening session of the Symposium on Vietnam. May I take this opportunity on behalf of the university to express our gratitude and appreciation to all of those invited guests who have traveled from near and far to be present from Sunday on for this symposium. We are very grateful for your having consented to come and for giving your time and of your intellect in this affair. I'd like also, while I have the chance, to express my personal appreciation to Professor Luddington and to Mrs. Helen Wilson of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense for their role in having arranged this symposium. The principal speaker tonight is General William C. Westmoreland, U.S. Army retired, a graduate of the class of 1936 at West Point. He fought in the Second World War with great distinction, held a series of command and staff positions in the period following the Second World War, including the role of superintendent of the United States Military Academy at West Point. In 1964, he went to Vietnam. 1965, was named Time Magazine Man of the Year and served as military commander of all U.S. forces in Vietnam in the period 1965 to 68, when he returned to Washington to become chief of staff of the U.S. Army. He will give the principal address tonight, and we are delighted to welcome General Westmoreland to the campus. He will be followed by Charles MacDonald, deputy chief historian of the U.S. Army Center of Military History in Washington, and the man in charge of writing the Army's history of the Vietnam conflict. Born in South Carolina, educated at Presbyterian College, Dr. MacDonald fought in the Second World War and has written and contributed widely to the U.S. Army's history of the Second World War. He also helped General Westmoreland in the preparation of his memoirs. Last on the left, to my farthest left on the panel is Morton Halpern, who will be the final respondent. Morton is an old friend of mine, and we welcome him back to this campus where he has visited on previous occasions. He taught at Harvard, served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Office of International Security Affairs, was a senior policy maker during the period of the Tet Offensive in the Pentagon, has served as on the National Security Council, has been a fellow at the Brookings Institute, and is now Director of National Security Studies for the American Civil Liberties Union and the Fund for Peace. He has the distinction of having written a number of articles and books, among them Bureaucratic Politics, a widely used text, and he has the honor of having won a lawsuit against former President Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, but not much damages. Let me briefly describe the format so no one is under any misapprehension. General Westmoreland is going to talk first for a period of 35 to 40 minutes. He'll be followed by Dr. MacDonald and then by Dr. Halpern. We will then go almost immediately to the audience for questions. I ask in your questions that you are crisp and to the point so that as many present may have a chance to give and take in what we truly think is an academic symposium. So we look forward to this evening's speeches, comments, and to your participation later. Thank you very much. General Westmoreland.
Thank you, Professor Williamson. Professor Luddington, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. When I left home yesterday, my wife inquired, "Where are you going this time?" I replied, "To Chapel Hill to speak to the university." Now, my wife is a North Carolinian and attended North Carolina University in Greensboro. So with a smile, she said, "That's a great, great honor. We'll have to inscribe that on your tombstone." I replied, "It sounds like a good idea, but let's don't rush it." Now, I was invited here by Professor Luddington to speak on the announced subject. I'm here to discuss a tragic era in our history, and to give you my views from my unique vantage point. And I assume that's why I was invited. Now, I'm not here to commend, endorse, or promote the Vietnam War. Neither do I condemn it. Perhaps I should also remind you that I did not start the war, nor did I make the big decisions. But I was one of those whose lot it was to be an implementer of our national policy. And I must say that I gave that task my very best efforts, as I think any professional officer does to the job that he's assigned. Now, I'd be less than frank if I did not say at the outset that I was deeply disappointed with the outcome in Vietnam after so many tried so diligently to make good our national policy. But I would like to also say that I have no apology for my conduct. I look at Vietnam through the end of a telescope, an end that is probably at the opposite end of the telescope or the lens that many of you were looking through. As you are keenly aware, recent years have been traumatic for America. Vietnam and Watergate have been center stage. The Vietnam episode has been dissected, it's been exposed, it's been exploited. The blame for that messy affair has been firmly placed. Lessons have been learned, some have been heeded. But not so for the Vietnam disaster. The military were at the center of action in that tragic affair. We believe, most of us, I think, who were in positions of senior responsibility, that we know from first-hand experience what happened and why. And we have no apology for our efforts. Someday, but not soon, history will put the matter in accurate perspective. We, those of us in uniform, and most of the civilians that were with us in Vietnam, to include the ambassador and many foreign service officers and many AID officers, I think we are proud, certainly I am, to have fought for what we believed was the principle of freedom. But I must say it is painful to me, and I would suspect most, to note what has happened. Now, let me make it clear here at the outset that those of us in uniform were dedicated by our professional oath to make good the commitments made by our political authority to the people of South Vietnam. No thoughtful citizen would want it any other way. But sadly, as you know, the Republic of Vietnam no longer exists. It's been gobbled up by North Vietnam following blatant aggression. The people of Indochina are now controlled by a ruthless bunch who say they're re-educating them. An estimated 1/8 of the Cambodians have died in the countryside. Firing squads are busy in Laos. In South Vietnam, thousands of so-called counter-revolutionaries are in concentration camps. Many have died. Human rights are non-existent. Thousands are trying to escape to freedom, an estimated 1,500 a month. The Hanoi regime has provided but little information on our MIAs, our missing in action, despite our urging time and time again to do so. The Vietnamese and the Cambodians are now fighting each other. And the ambassador from Hanoi to the United Nations has recently been expelled for running a spy ring against the United States. The flicker of the torch of freedom in Vietnam has been extinguished, perhaps forever. Our erstwhile honorable country betrayed and deserted the Republic of Vietnam after it had enticed it to its bosom. It was a shabby performance by America, a blemish on our history, and a possible blight on our future. The Vietnam episode may be a watershed for America, but particularly on the effect it has had on our youth. Our international credibility has been damaged. In our national interest, that unhappy experience should not be swept under the rug and forgotten, because there are lessons to be learned and vulnerabilities in our national system that need careful examination. As one who lived closely with the matter for many years, my observations and analyses may be of interest to this group of prominent citizens and future prominent citizens. I believe it was Josh Billings who said of the American public, "It is not so much that we're ignorant, but we know so much that is not true." In other words, perceptions are not always based on facts. There is, however, one valid truth accepted by most. The handling of the Vietnam episode was a shameful national blunder. Our interest in Vietnam was born in the post-World War II period, motivated by a concern for unchecked communist movement into insecure and unstable areas around the world. In 1947, President Truman enunciated a national policy known as the Truman Doctrine that pledged us to the unconditional support of free people who are resisting attempted subjugation by minorities or by outside pressures. The Congress approved this doctrine in 1947 by a large majority. In 1950, we sent a military mission to Saigon. President Eisenhower emphasized the policy of containment in association with his massive retaliation strategy. The domino theory was born. Upon the initiative of Secretary of State Dulles, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, CETO, was formed, and the treaty ratified by the United States Senate in 1955 with only one dissenting vote. When Mr. Kennedy was elected president, he became interested in the so-called small war concept, became concerned about the size and readiness of the army that he thought had been neglected under President Eisenhower. President Kennedy increased the size of the army and personally sponsored the Army's Green Berets, the Army Special Forces. President Kennedy anticipated the advent of nuclear parity between the United States and the Soviet Union. The president was very sensitive to the failure of his Bay of Pigs venture. After his verbal confrontation with Chairman Khrushchev in Vienna in 1961, where Mr. Khrushchev boasted, "We will bury you," he said, Mr. Kennedy reportedly told Scotty Reston in the New York Times, and I quote, "We have a problem in making our power credible, and Vietnam looks like the place." President Kennedy set the tone of his administration in his inaugural address when he pledged our nation to bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, and oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty. Foremost in the president's mind was how to discourage or defeat the Soviet-sponsored wars of national liberation. Hence, President Kennedy greatly increased our military effort in Vietnam with advisors, Green Berets, American manned helicopters, and tactical aircraft. The young president, in his zeal, made a grievous mistake in approving our involvement in the overthrow of President Diem of South Vietnam. This action, in my opinion, morally locked us in Vietnam. Political chaos prevailed in South Vietnam for 2 years. No one knows it better than I, because I was there. It was like trying to push a piece of spaghetti. Now, if not for our own interference in the political affairs of South Vietnam, and based on pragmatic considerations, We could, in my opinion, have gracefully withdrawn our support at that time from South Vietnam in view of a demonstrated lack of unity. We could have made a case that the seeds of unity and the seeds for South Vietnam to become a self-sufficient political entity was lacking. On the other hand, in the wake of Mr. Kennedy's inaugural pronouncements, it is very doubtful if his or Mr. Johnson's administration would have risked the likely domestic political repercussions because Mr. Kennedy's inaugural address was still ringing in the ears of Americans. President Johnson inherited the problem and retained most of Mr. Kennedy's advisors. Mr. Johnson was obsessed with his Great Society program. In the hope that the war would go away, he made some decisions with the endorsement of congressional leaders that were destined to drag the war on indefinitely. He expanded our military effort to avoid inevitable defeat and increased the national debt to do so.